From 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, welcome to The Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you, and from the Palladium at the Center for the Performing Arts. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Buscelli Wallerab Jazz Orchestra from their Heart and Soul album, available on iTunes.
I'm Sharon Gamble. Welcome to The Art of the Matter. This week, we'll meet a tattoo artist who had an epiphany when he volunteered to help the homeless. We'll discover why John James Audubon had to move abroad to get appreciated at home. And we'll meet an artist who refused to let a Parkinson's diagnosis sideline him. And don't forget, we'll have that arts calendar we call What'll We Do? All that and more right after the latest news from NPR. Welcome back to The Art of the Matter from 90.1 WFYI Public Radio. I'm Sharon Gamble. On today's show, we'll cook with an American Pianists Association fellow. But first, Wendell Lowe is a local artist who had to reinvent his approach to creating when he was diagnosed with Parkinson's disease. He'll be presenting a powerful solo exhibit called Artist Boxer, This Is My Parkinson's, for April's first Friday. Shannon Forsell, artistic director of the Cabaret, talked with Wendell about the exhibit and his process.
The show is called This Is My Parkinson's, and it's in partnership with Rock Steady Boxing. And in fact, many of the proceeds will go to Rock Steady Boxing. So I want to talk to you a little bit, Wendell, about your story, because you were an artist that had a completely different kind of style until Parkinson's became a big part of your life. And so let's talk about 2009.
All right. When you say 2009... sounds pretty scary to me. That was one of the worst times of my life. Imagine that being diagnosed with Parkinson's happened in 2009. And then about 3 weeks later, I was diagnosed with stage 3 colon cancer. So that's not fun. And then my baby sister, Amy, passed away of lung cancer. So it was just way, way too much happening that particular year. But we dealt with the cancer part first. You know, I did the operation and the chemotherapy and made it through all that and kind of put that behind me. Now we started probably in 2012 or whatever working on the Parkinson's.
Right.
And it's frustrating that Parkinson's is the last thing an artist wants to have because it takes away everything you need to create. So it's extra rough for people like me, but I've adapted. I've had to change this way that I do art as the disease progresses, and so that's been kind of positive because I think I'm doing my best work now because of the change.
Yeah, how would you describe, you know, one of the things when we talked is that there's also a gift of Parkinson's, you know,
yeah.
And so how was your art different before 2009 and your style now?
Well, before I was doing kind of more realistic pastel. Well, I was always doing photography, and thank God for things with that steady cameras because my hand shakes quite a bit when I'm taking them, but they turn out pretty well. And so I was always doing the photography and started out more realistically. Then as the disease has progressed, I've had to kind of switch to not being able to use a paintbrush, but use my fingers.
Mm-hmm.
That's how kind of the finger painting stuff has kind of arrived out of necessity there. I couldn't control a paintbrush and do detailed painting, but I can press my hand up against the paper or canvas and move them around to different, and kind of move them by the way I feel at the time.
Mm-hmm.
So this finger painting side of what I do has been great art therapy for me. And it's helped quite a bit.
You know, and just for the listeners, you know, because I would say that one of the things to do is to go to these websites, which we're going to talk about in just a second, to see his work. Because when you describe finger painting, you know, to the average listener, that seems like, you know, like a 5-year-old with big, thick lines. But your work, while you say finger painting, is extremely intricate and sophisticated and abstract. And so the work is
well, thank
it's
you.
Fantastic.
Thank you.
It's gorgeous pieces that...
Well, I've got pieces that are maybe large scale, like 6-foot by 5-foot size finger paintings, and I've got ones that are smaller. And then now I've had my new stuff that I do. I call them fingerprints, which I take my photography that I've taken, and I actually print them on inkjet prints in a slow drying method. And then while they're wet, I actually draw into my photography with my fingers. So they're called fingerprints.
Oh, they're fantastic.
And you get some pretty interesting results that way.
And so folks can see your work before they come to the gallery at what websites?
Well, there's just simply my name, windelow.com. You just go there mm-hmm. and you can see my work. That's kind of more of my more realistic and abstract photography side. And then you can go to fineartamerica.com and then click on Windelow, and you'll see all my abstract finger paintings and therapeutic
right.
you know, type artwork that I do.
And you said that you're going to kind of have both of those styles
I'm
at this exhibit.
I'm going to have both of them at the show, and I'm going to try to blend them together at the same time.
And there's going to be some video about how you create your work and how you do your work?
There's going to be a video of that, and my daughter's putting together some special videos also. She kind of does that on the side. And, there'll be a lot of video from Rocksteady Boxing, which we haven't talked about yet.
Yeah, they've changed your life. You talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, they really have. I kind of feel like I have the best balance of treatment. I mean, I've got a great doctor at IU Hospitals. I've got my art that I do, which is a great therapy. And then I've got Rocksteady Boxing for Parkinson's, which a lot of people know about, I'm sure. They're getting more and more popular. They're so popular right now. They've grown in 2 years. They have over 300 affiliates all over the world right now, just within
wow.
2 years.
And so, they've given to you, and now you're giving back to them through
exactly.
this exhibit, which is really beautiful. I mean, you know, this is a sad story, no doubt. But when I see you, and for those listeners, you are a vibrant person, and your work is vibrant and beautiful. So it's come out of this experience, but creating so much beauty in the world. And I think folks really need to see this exhibit. Again, it's hard to talk about art on the radio and to express to you guys, I mean, how fantastic this work is. But I encourage you to head out to Indiana Landmarks on First Friday, April 7th, to see Wendell Lowe and his fantastic and inspiring work to also help out the cause of Rocksteady Boxing.
And I was told you could feel free to bring the kids, and it's a free show.
And oh, thank you so much. It's free, absolutely.
Yeah.
And I already am going to lose a lot of money by going and buying a bunch of your work at that night. So we are looking forward
hurry
to
up
the
and
show.
Get a bunch more done.
Right. So check that out. Thanks so much, Wendell.
Thank you.
Contributor Shannon Forsell with artist Wendell Lowe. His exhibit called Artist Boxer, This Is My Parkinson's, will be on view in the Rapp Gallery at Indiana Landmark Center on Friday evening, April 7th, from 6 to 9. Haunted by the disappearance of his mother when he was 8 years old, Detective Hud Matthews begins his own investigation to find out what really happened so many years before. When a rare murder occurs in the lakeside community where he serves on the force, Hud's veteran skills are called upon to capture the killer. That's the setup for Larry Swayze's latest book, his 13th novel, and I did my own sleuthing to discover where he finds his plots and characters. Where did this lead character come to you from? Is it based on somebody you know?
Hud Matthews has been bouncing around in my head for a long time. What I really wanted to do with him is I had an image of him as a boy and then as a man. And all of the things that happened to him as a boy drove who he became as a man. The questions he asked as a boy led him to become a detective,
mm-hmm.
a question answerer, and a person who sought justice, not just for himself, but for other people. So I wanted to explore the relationship between the boy and the man and where a detective really evolves from.
Mm-hmm. Is Demi Lake based on a real place or a kind of a concatenation of places?
Because
I kept thinking Lake Wawasee at some
point.
Ah,
there you go. it's fictional. It's a can't. There's your word. So when I was a kid, my grandparents lived on Irish Lake, which is in the Barbee Lake chains, which is just a little south of Wawasee. It's up by North Webster and Warsaw. So my grandparents moved there when I was five, and they moved away after I left home, at you know, after I graduated high school. So my summers and winters were spent going to the lakes. So a lot of Dimmy Lake is based on what I digested as a kid. As a matter, there's the dip, which is in the novel, is a an ice cream stand that had a little zoo behind it. Actually, when we went to my grandparents' house, we would go down a dip, and there was a man who rescued wild animals. So there was a lion, there was a bear.
That, I have to say that when I first encountered that in the novel, I was kind of, that's kind of horrifying and fascinating too.
So when I was a kid, I actually, you know, we would hear the lion roar at night. And my grandmother, being my, you know, being a, you know, such a mothering person, was always worried about that lion, you know, getting out. And,
of course.
You know, coming her way. So,
well, you know, this what I love about the novel is it's so beautifully atmospheric. And this man, Hud, is he's not in any way, shape or form. And given your background writing mystery, you could easily just put in a stock character. He's not a stock character. He's very three-dimensional, and you can tell he's haunted. He's haunted by this boyhood that you talked about and by something that happened when he moved away, when he was on the beat up in Detroit.
Yeah, Hud's really kind of, you know, he's flawed. He's kind of, he's broken, and I think, I don't know, I think, you know, I think most interesting characters have a broken part in them. Hud moved away from the lakes, I think, to get away from the mystery of his mother disappearing, and to have his own life. And, you know, he made some wrong turns and had an incident where he was ratted out by his snitch and his, you know, there was a face-off, and one of them came out alive and one of them came out wounded. And so, you know, Hud has that experience of killing a man as well as all, you know, the hauntings from his mother disappearing when he was a kid.
And then these unsolved mysteries that are happening one after another, and somebody seems to be in hot pursuit of Hud now that he's back in his home.
What Hud does best is ask questions. And you know, when you go back home and you start asking questions about what happened 20 years ago, sometimes you ask the wrong person the right question.
Noblesville novelist Larry Swayze. His newest book is called Where I Can See You, and you can check out Larry's blog and learn about his other mysteries and westerns and other writing at LarryDSwayze.com. Larry D. Swayze, and Swayze is S-W-E-A-Z-Y. You're listening to The Art of the Matter on 90.1 WFYI Public Radio. I'm Sharon Gamble. Later this hour, we meet a tattoo artist called Shadow. But first, Eat Drink Indie's Jolene Ketzenberger talks with Brian Alvey of the new River City Winery Tasting Room that just opened in Franklin.
Tell me about River City Winery and why here in Franklin, you know, and how that all came about.
Well, with all my background that I've had in the bar, restaurant, beverage, wine industry, you would think it would be that, my connection with the owner of the winery and the winemaker, Gary Humphreys, but we actually met through a similar community within the military. That's how we met. This industry is how we gravitated into a friendship rather quickly, and the geographical, we're an hour and a half from one another. It's just the easiest drive in the world, just go straight down 65 and hit New Albany. We've always just talked, a lot of similar interests, and then last May, we're just like, probably a couple bottles of wine. We're like, hey, I got an idea. And he was wanting to do a tasting room. I lived in Franklin. I guess about it just was a perfect mix. And there's no brainer. Then this location became available, and we just pulled the trigger and went with it. And here we are. So Gary started the winery back in 07 down on downtown New Albany on 123 Pearl Street. Old building that was empty, and the downtown New Albany area was struggling, and he was really one of those that walked point on revitalizing. He actually fell in love with the building before he decided to make wine. He's like, okay, I want to get this building. I want to save it. What am I going to do in it? And he's like, I know, a winery. So he got the vineyard, Eagle Crest Vineyard, up, and he's been making wine ever since. And since 07, he's accumulated a significant amount of trophies and medals for his ability to make amazing wine.
From looking at the tasting notes here, it seems like there are a lot of award winners, certainly with the Indy International Wine Competition.
Yes, and Gary does his fair share of judging now as well, and he doesn't miss. That's an excellent, excellent event. That's definitely one that Gary won't miss.
Then you have a kind of a history in the wine industry and with wine dinners and that sort of thing. So this isn't anything new for you, right?
No, I had an event venue for a while. We did a lot of wine tastings and stuff. I used to own Agostino's Italian restaurant and wine bar, where we routinely were rated in the top three with the different contests and whatnot up in the city of Indianapolis every year as a wine bar and as an Italian restaurant. I think the last year we were in operation, we were number three behind Mama Carolla's and Iria's, which I thought was a great company to be in. It was an honor, and I'm glad we didn't beat them because I didn't want to live up to that. And then same with the wine bar. We were the only people that were popping up on the radar with wine south of Fountain Square, you know, in Indianapolis. We're on the south side, and then, you know, us and then Vino Villa. Vino Villa has always been one of my go-to spots for sure as well. So give them a lot of credit.
So tell me about the new tasting room in Franklin. How has the reception been?
It's been excellent. We've been packed since we opened silently on Thursday evening. We've been packed ever since. So we've been here, what, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, and now we're here on Sunday. And we're staying full.
So why do you think that is? What's the appeal of a tasting room? And give me a little bit of the background of the winery, too.
Sure. Well, first off, we have good juice. The wine is excellent. The second thing is, you know, Franklin is growing. It's a wonderful controlled growth. So we're not growing just for the sake of growing. The things that are going on in historic downtown Franklin are amazing. We've got new breweries popping up, restaurants, and just boutiques. All these really wonderful. So a winery to me was just a logical fit to diversify the offerings a little bit, and I think Franklin was absolutely past being ready for it, and they're proving it. They're just rolling in the front door.
So you didn't have a winery in downtown Franklin or a tasting room or anything like that, right?
The closest was Mallow Run up in Whiteland, and they're wonderful, and we compete with, not against them. And we definitely recommend that anybody that enjoys wine, make sure they stop by them. So hit them and then come see us in the evening, because we're opening in the evenings on the week. Monday through Friday we open at 4, and then on the weekends right now currently opening at noon Saturday and Sunday.
And you're open late too, right?
Yeah, we keep hearing the locals beat the drum that there's nothing to do on Sunday night in Franklin, so we're going to give it a shot for a while. So we're staying open until 11 on Saturday and Sunday and Friday as well. And we'll just see how it goes.
Well, now, tell me what people can expect when they come in.
Well, you're going to get an opportunity to taste some wines. We're going to help you navigate our wines to find the ones that you prefer. And then you can buy by the glass, by the bottle, by the case, however you wish. We are a winery, operate a winery's license. So the one big question comes up, can we do carry out on Sundays? Absolutely, we can do carry out on Sundays. And we just nice environment where you can sit and enjoy your wines here, take some with, and the outside seating's coming soon. We're right here on Main Street, about equal distance between the courthouse from the historic Art Craft Theater, and the view's amazing, and the location's amazing. So that's why we jumped on this location when it freed up.
You can hear Jolene Ketzenberger's Eat, Drink, Indie Saturday mornings at 11 on WFYI HD2, The Point. Sam Hong is one of the American Pianists Association's Classical Fellowship finalists, and WFYI's Jill Dittmeyer has been introducing us to the five finalists as they prepare for the gala finals on April 7th and 8th at Hilbert Circle Theater. Tell us, Jill.
Well, Sharon, when I met with Sam for our interview, I had just watched one of the APA's YouTube interviews that they put up on their website, which is AmericanPianistAssociation.org. Lee Clifford does these interviews with the finalists, and they're terrific to watch, and I urge anybody to go to the website and take a look at him. And on Sam's video, he was actually in the midst of cooking dinner for some of his friends. So when he came to have this conversation with me, I decided to start that conversation with a follow-up to his meal.
I was making stir fry, yeah.
Do you like to cook?
I actually really like to cook. I think the biggest difficulty is just practicality and, you know, whether the time to just constantly be making meals exists or not. But it's so much fun, and it always tastes better when you do it yourself. So,
what do you like to cook?
I like to just try recipes that my friends. I cook Korean food. I have a good friend named Antoine who's a French chef, and I just get ideas from him. You know, I'm really a hobbyist, right? So I just go more by novelty than having a standby recipe or anything like that.
So what are you cooking right now? What's your food hobby at the moment?
I'm not cooking anything right now because I've been practicing a lot.
Well, and this is why I'm asking this, because we always think of athletes have to have a dietary curriculum. What about musicians? How important is diet in your
That's a
protocol?
Really interesting question. And I think musicians tend to neglect that a lot because somehow we feel like if we're suffering, we can make better music or something like that. But I don't think it's particularly critical. I know that playing music is actually much more of a physical act than it may seem. You know, we're not always just enjoying ourselves. You know, there's a lot of technical things that go into that. But we probably should take care of that more.
Sam started out playing the cello, but it wasn't long before the piano stole his heart.
As a pianist, we have the opportunity to create and shape every part of the music. We're not bound by which pianist we're working with. If we're a string player, you know, we usually play with a pianist. And we're actually very much in control of every element. And so I think it just increases the creative potential.
Is it the control factor or the creative factor?
Well, I think control might be necessary to have the ideal creative expression.
But you like to collaborate, too, with other musicians as well.
I really do love to collaborate. And I play in a piano trio called Trio Saint Bernard. But that's also, you know, even in collaboration, I think now I'm really sounding like a control freak. So even in chamber music, I think the piano plays a role of like two instruments rather than if you have a violin and a cello and a piano. It's been said often that the piano is kind of takes on just it's like a chameleon. It takes on many different musical roles. And I think that keeps it fresh for me. I don't really like routine, and I don't like it when things stay the same for too long. Chamber music, I think, is one of the great ways we can promote classical music because it's visually very rich and interesting. You know, when the music goes from one line to another, it's very obvious. And it is true that this same thing happens with orchestra, lots of different instruments, and you can kind of visually track it. But it's hard in an orchestra because there are so many people. You sit very far away. But in the context of chamber music, like when there's three people playing, somebody takes the main line over, you know it right away. And so I think actually visual interest and understanding is a big part of being able to kind of increase the popularity of classical music.
If you win this fellowship, what will it mean to you and how will it change your career path, or will it?
It will definitely, I think. So I play lots of different kinds of settings when I'm playing piano concerts. But I have a few things in mind. I think the future of music, of classical music, is really in the chamber music. And I am constantly, it's kind of like my musical life pursuit, constantly looking for ways to bring the great piano music that we have into a collaborative kind of setting, which is easier to just understand, and it's kind of fun to watch. And I have a couple of secret projects in mind, which I'm still working on, whether, you know, no matter what the results of this fellowship.
Can you give us any hint to those secret projects, what they might be, what they might entail?
It's a lot of taking music that we know very well, for example, like the Moonlight Sonata, Clair de Lune, which are piano pieces, but to take those pieces and to find different ways to represent them and different different ways to present them so that they are visually very accessible and both aurally and visually colorful, and so kind of reinterpreting masterworks.
Well, that was a delicious interview.
Yes, and Sam does have a lot of plans. If he would win the fellowship, it's $100,000 to the winner, and they can do with it what they would like. And as he said, he really appreciates classical music, and he'd like to put his own spin on it as well. He also likes to listen to classical music, but he likes to listen to strings. He said that's kind of his favorite type of classical, as opposed to listening to the other pianists, I guess, which makes sense. But that Discovery series is coming up. It's the week of April the 3rd, and you'll be able to hear presentations every night on WFYI right here, 90.1, as they perform at the Christchurch Cathedral downtown. And then, of course, Sunday night, you will at 7 o'clock be able to hear Sam's performance that he recorded when he was here in town earlier this year.
Absolutely. And if that's not enough great things to listen to and consume in the arts, we have some more things to suggest to you on our calendar that we call
What'll We Do?
So this is a little ways away, but I wanted to get it on your calendar now. On Sunday, April 23rd, from 1 to 4 at the Indianapolis Museum of Art, there is a talk called Celebrate Spring with the IMA Horticultural Society, and a tour following called Spring Blooms, a Celebration of Color. And all of this is in conjunction with the new Audubon exhibit, Audubon's Birds of America artwork that will be on view inside the museum. You'll have a chance to take a tour of the garden with Jonathan Wright, who's the relatively new Ruth Lilly Deputy Director for Horticulture and Natural Resources, and Chad Frainer, who's Director of Horticulture. Also, Jim McCormick, who has spent 31 years working for the Ohio Department of Natural Resources as a botanist and bird specialist, will talk about John James Audubon's style and his unique talent for presenting birds as art. All of that is going on Sunday, April 23rd, and you can find more about that online.
And here's one that's happening this week if you're listening to us on Saturday. So put this on your calendar. It's a very interesting presentation. March 22nd at 5:30 at the Indiana Medical History Museum, Diane Tolliver is going to be giving a lecture on the Indiana Angel of Death. Many people remember this Orville Lynn Majors. He was a former licensed practical nurse in Indiana, and he was nicknamed the Angel of Death after a very lengthy investigation. His victims were aged 56 to 89. They were all supposedly in stable condition, but then they died suddenly as he was taking care of them. So once again, this is all about forensics and science, and if you're a CSI fan, you might want to check out this lecture on March the 22nd at the Indiana Medical History Museum.
That is creepy and cool. I love it. Hey, on a quite different note, families can step right up. If that sounds like the circus, it is, because the Indiana Historical Society is giving free admission for its circus tradition on Saturday, March 25th. It's the 16th annual Circus Day celebration featuring family-friendly carnival activities, live performances, and the Indiana Experience. Families can learn about rescued animals with the Amazing World of Animals show featuring Paul Venkus with Hedgehog Hannah. Also live performances including the return of the Hample Family Circus, balloon sculptures, face painting, all sorts of fun things appropriate even for little kids. And while you're there, you can see the Indiana Historical Society's newest exhibit, 1943 Italian POWs at Atterbury. Lots more going on Circus Day, March 25th.
And if you don't want to step on up, you can step on us. It's a sidewalk poetry contest going underway right now in the Zionsville Cultural District. They're calling out to residents to write a poem, keep it short, They're going to choose the winners, and then those poems are actually going to be stamped into the sidewalks in the village there in Zionsville. So people can literally walk on words.
Wow.
It's a great idea, and it's like one of only a handful going on in the country. And so they're accepting entries right now, and there's a very small entry fee. But gee whiz, your words will be there in sidewalk forever.
Maybe that's not forever, exciting. But pretty close to it.
ZionsvilleCulturalDistrict.org. That's their website, and you can get all the information there to become a permanent part of the village.
Speaking of words, Indy's hilarious two-man completely improvised musical, which is called Dudesicle, will stage a run of shows at Comedy Sports Indy Theater Friday nights in April. This is a 10 o'clock show, which if you've ever been to Comedy Sports tells you, uh-oh, it's not family-friendly. It's for age 17 and older because there might be some grown-up language. By the way, it's not a dude popsicle. It's just two dudes doing a musical, but it's an improvised musical, so laughter is sure to abound. That's going on at Comedy Sports Friday nights at 10 through April.
And Book Marmas over there in Irvington at 9 Johnson Avenue. They have a whole slew of local authors lined up for the rest of this month and part of April as well. A lot of original poetry and artwork on display too by some of them. All kinds of different books on different topics by local authors. Visit their website, bookmamas.com, for specific times and dates.
Well, you know, if we haven't given you enough suggestions for what to do, you can always learn more about local arts events at indiearts.org/guide, the Arts Council of Indianapolis's Indie Arts Guide, or tune back in next week for our calendar that we call What Do We Do?
You're listening to The Art of the Matter, a weekly show about the arts in Indianapolis and central Indiana. Your host is Sharon Gamble. If your arts organization has an event or activity of which you think we should be aware, please contact us at least 3 weeks in advance. You can write us at The Art of the Matter, care of WFYI, 1630 North Meridian Street, Indianapolis, Indiana, 46202, or you can email us at aotm@wfyi.org. You can also hear The Art of the Matter on WFYI.org.
You're listening to The Art of the Matter on 90.1 WFYI Public Radio. I'm Sharon Gamble. In just a bit, why John James Audubon had to leave home to get discovered. But first, Shadow is the owner of the Ink Family Tattoo Shop, and he's also a highly sought-after tattoo artist. Contributor Alicia Hall invited Shadow to talk about how art, the struggle to become a tattoo artist, and volunteering with a group of homeless people in downtown Indianapolis changed how he viewed his role within the community.
Every piece that he does, he enjoys doing it. He's not just doing it to get paid.
Thank you, bro.
That's the biggest. That's why I personally come.
Ink Family Tattoo Shop is on the south side of Indy and sits in a strip mall with a karate studio, a State Farm agent, and a barbershop. Owner Shadow was conceptualizing a Jesus tattoo with longtime customer Orville. He was also making Snapchat videos for his followers to be in on the process.
Yeah. Hold on, turn this way just a little bit. Your arm, though. Not just your head. Yeah. Your head doesn't matter as much. All right, this is my sketch, how we're going to fix it. You saw the before. This is about to be the after.
In addition to traditional tattooing, Shadow does watercolor pieces that look as though he painted them directly onto the customer. The way he positions the image, the ink looks like a colorful masterpiece from his sketchbook rather than body art. He says that every piece he does is important and super personal. Throughout my interview with him, Shadow talked about the crazy life he lived before he began tattooing. He didn't go into much detail, but he did talk about losing friends because of that lifestyle.
I could name you so many people. I have so many RIP tattoos on me.
After facing many obstacles to become a tattoo artist, Shadow has become very successful. He's won a lot of awards, traveled around the United States, and because of a recent sponsorship from a large equipment supplier, he will be able to do his work internationally. But he says he wasn't always appreciative.
I didn't realize how ungrateful I had been for all the blessings that I'd had.
It wasn't until a client invited him to volunteer with the homeless that he began to think about how he could give back to the community.
Why didn't I think of that? Like, I want to go. And I was like, I got all kinds of clothes. I got all kinds of stuff I can give. So she was like, cool. So she told me where to go. And I went with her downtown to the Under the Bridge group, I guess. And I started working with them for a couple weeks.
Then he realized he could use his large social media following to attract more people to serve the community.
I put on Facebook I was going out there, and I went out and I just took like one picture of what it looked like, just to kind of, because I feel like a lot of people would probably be nervous to go out there, feel like they wouldn't, you know what I mean? Like the fear of the unknown would make a lot of people probably not want to do that. When I put it on there, the next week I went out, I asked if anybody wanted to go with me, and I had like 14 people show up, and every one of them had multiple bags of stuff. So it was like I was like instantly, I was like, oh my God, if I can do this so easily, I need to start doing this so easily. So then I did it again and did it again. I finally started just collecting, and people were bringing up bags and bags and bags of stuff. So honestly, it's been the community that's done it. All I had to do was just be the springboard for showing them that that's what I wanted to focus on, or that that was the need in our town.
After working with the homeless population for a while, Shadow started to think about how he could benefit kids in Indianapolis using his artistic abilities.
So my goal, honestly, is to become extremely wealthy and then start making stuff for kids to do that are like, let's say, 6 to like 18, 19, that are like artistically motivated. So I want to have like an outlet for kids to make music here where they can like learn how to make beats and learn how to like record themselves making music and not have to go get hustled by somebody or go have to already have a bunch of money to do it. Mm-hmm. I want to show kids how to make art and graffiti and stuff like that, or airbrushing or tattooing, and be able to like not have them have to be wealthy to start off.
Shadow said that he's not interested in taking his talents to another city. He believes he's more than just a tattoo artist. He's a member of this community, and he has work to do.
Just trying to make this city a little bit happier and a little bit more positive every day, and doing my part to make everybody a little bit more happy and carefree, you know?
Mm-hmm. Contributor Alicia Hall with Shadow. Learn more about Ink Family Tattoo by searching Ink Fam, that's INKFAM, Tattoo, on Facebook. The Indianapolis Museum of Art is about to go to the birds. Starting April 1st, you can experience the lifelike drawings of John James Audubon. These portraits of avians, from stern owls to playful parakeets, are featured in an immersive gallery where you can compare your own wingspan to that of your favorite birds, as well as hear their distinctive calls. I invited curator Marty Krause to talk about why this 19th century self-taught artist seems so modern.
So I have to say, Audubon strikes me as kind of a classic success story in that they didn't appreciate him here, so he went away.
That's true. He had spent probably 5 years seriously doing bird drawings out in the West, West being Kentucky and the Mississippi Valley, because that was pretty much the end of the country in 1820. And he took a portfolio of about 300 of these life-size drawings, watercolors of birds, to Philadelphia, which was sort of the heart of the scientific and artistic community in the country in those years. And this was 1824. And he was, you know, ignored and actually blackballed by the academic institutions because he really had no credentials, either as an artist or as a ornithologist.
He had was stunning lifelike
absolutely
paintings,
but because they were involved in a previous ornithology written by Alexander Wilson, which was being supported by the Academy of Sciences. Mm-hmm. That they sort of dismissed him, and the engraver he went to see said, these cannot be turned into engravings. So Audubon went to England, and essentially by dint of hard work and just peddling his wares, he secured not only academic recognition, but also the interest of an engraver. So, and he actually promoted himself, which he couldn't have done in this country, by sort of assuming this frontier persona, even though he was a French immigrant from the Caribbean. But he'd wear a buckskin coat and,
Let his hair grow long. Yeah.
And, you know, he was accepted sort of like a latter-day Benjamin Franklin, this sort of primitive genius. And all the doors of Europe opened to him. And then 3 years later, when he comes back to the United States for the first time, all of a sudden, he's embraced by not only the academic world in the United States, but also invited to the White House and all of that. So it's really an incredible story.
Wow, and accepted to the same academy that had
rejected him before.
Absolutely. I love that. How did he get interested in nature and specifically in birds? What do we know about that?
Well, he had a lot of leisure time. His father, who was a French sea captain, had sent him to this farm that he owned in Pennsylvania when he was 18 years old. Well, the farm had a tenant farmer and a manager, so Audubon really had nothing to do, and he had always had an interest in nature, so he began indulging his passion for drawing birds in lifelike poses, which he would accomplish by sort of pinning them up on this board that he devised. And he carried that with him when he went to Kentucky in 1808 with his new bride. But it was more of a pastime because he had business interests.
Was he entirely self-taught with art?
Absolutely self-taught. Now, he claimed at one time to have had lessons from Jacques-Louis David, but that's one of those sort of myths that he created around himself to give himself a certain amount of credence.
Some street cred.
But, you know, he was illegitimate by birth, and some of those people sort of just create themselves, that's what he did. He created John James Audubon, and so after his businesses went bankrupt in 1819, that's when he really embarked on devoting himself full time to this mission of drawing all the birds of America.
Now, was it unusual to draw them and paint them life size?
It was a totally new concept. Before, the drawings were more or less scientific in nature and were merely meant to illustrate the text. So you would oftentimes have five or six or seven different species on a single plate in a book. Audubon had this notion that they should be presented life-sized and in color and animated, which was completely different and completely new, and resulted in one of the most beautiful books of engraved plates of the 19th century.
Well, I mean, if we stepped outside the studio and stopped the next 10 people and said Audubon, they would say bird.
Sure.
I mean,
absolutely.
He owns birds.
He became
synonymous
with that and with conservation efforts.
Yeah. He liked to go out and observe them in the natural habitat. What do we know? Did he take a sketch pad and a pencil? Did he make notes? I mean, obviously, this is pre-photography. We know he also captured them. And did he do the taxidermy himself?
Well, sometimes it wasn't even taxidermy. He would draw from fresh kills because he felt that the plumage faded rapidly, so he did not usually work from stuffed specimens. But he would draw wherever he was in his studio, let's say, but he never actually had a studio. But he would make his notes in the field, and he was an avid hunter, so he would either bring back specimens to his studio or purchase them on the market.
And he, somebody who's cringing about, killing birds, killing the very birds that you're trying to publicize. But he was an early conservationist.
Over time, he became so because he, in the 30-year process of publishing The Birds of America, he noticed the changes in the landscapes where once certain species had been very common, like the passenger pigeon or the Carolina parakeet. They were either disappearing or had disappeared altogether. So, and he noticed particularly in the Southeast the depredations that were caused on the particularly the herons and the egrets who would be plumed for ladies' hats, or the eggers up in the Northeast who would use birds for fish bait or that sort of thing, then decimated whole populations of these animals. And so Audubon, at the end of his career, was calling for government measures to protect the wild.
Wow, if he could have lived a few more centuries, he would have been thrilled.
Yeah, and it's interesting, the Audubon Society, of which he really had no connection outside of lending his name to, was founded by a fellow who had been a former student of his wife in one of the little private schools that she taught in down in Louisiana. But it's just a coincidence that happened.
Wow, crazy. I love that there's some kind of interactivity in this exhibition. We can go in and hear calls. And
yes, there's
kind of
an immersive gallery which is being developed by a company in Milan. As opposed to Milan.
Oh, please tell me you had to go to Milan.
I did not.
Darn it.
which is going to recreate. There's a gallery. It's called an immersive space. Mm-hmm. And the sort of Louisiana swamp will be recreated visually. You won't have to slog through it, but on the walls. And Audubon's birds that were found in that habitat will be animated by this company, actually using Audubon's plates from the Birds of America. And it will go from, sort of dawn till night, and the various species that are active at those times of day will be animated, and there'll be bird calls and that sort of thing. So it will be an immersive experience.
The IMA's curator of prints, drawings, and photographs, Marty Krause. You can see Audubon Drawn to Nature from April 1st through July 30th, and there's lots of bonus programming you can check out at imamuseum.org. Rick Wilkerson likes records, and when I say records, feel free to picture the old-school kind. That's right, vinyl. 20,000 albums just waiting for you to listen to them. A Cultural Manifesto's Kyle Long talked with Rick about his business, Irvington Vinyl.
I'm Kyle Long from Cultural Manifesto. I'm joined today by Rick Wilkerson, the owner of Irvington Vinyl, located on the east side in the Irvington neighborhood. Rick, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
My pleasure. I'm a longtime fan of your many record stores, going back to Missing Link, which started out on the South Side. So I'm a big fan of your record shops and the music you recorded here as part of the punk and new wave movement back in the 1980s. So thanks for being here. You have five songs to share with us. What's first?
First up, let's do one of my favorite bands of all time and their best track, Television Marquee Moon. Yeah, funny story about Television. I saw Television live open for Peter Gabriel in like 1977. Before I knew who Television was, I was there to see Peter Gabriel because I was his big Genesis fan. And so go up to Chicago and we're watching, everybody's waiting for Peter Gabriel to come out in his first solo tour. And these ragged, punk rock guys come out in like torn up flannel shirts and stuff. And they started playing these weird guitars. And nobody knew what to make of it. It was the damnedest thing. I'm sure that there were people who went there to see Television, but I didn't know who they were. And so basically people in the audience were both booing and cheering simultaneously. I've never seen a show quite like that. By the end of it, they had sold me, though. I was starting to understand what they were trying to do, although it would take me many years to become a fan.
And I bought this record at your record shop, Missing Link, in the 90s.
We always tried to keep it in stock. And that's still a promise at Irvington Vinyl. We always have that record in stock.
Awesome.
Second song is going to be from my Krautrock collection. I'm a big fan of this stuff, and a band called Amandul 2, Surrounded by the Stars.
And for Art of the Matter listeners who aren't heavy krautrock fans, just give us a quick description of this genre.
Krautrock generally refers to German rock bands from the 70s. There's a variety of different sounds, but most of the interest is on some of the more creative and off-center versions, things that go down kind of a psychedelic or progressive path. Come and jump on my Are You Tired machine. Third song is going to be by Grace Potter, my favorite current contemporary artist, and this one is called The Lion, the Beast, and the Beat.
And your fourth song, Rick?
Number four is from an album that actually came out in 2016 that I'm very fond of. It's a band, I think they're from Los Angeles, called Warpaint, and this is called New Song.
And your fifth and final song for us.
Going back for another blast from the past, we're going to hear from Hawkwind and their hit Silver Machine.
Yeah, tell us about Hawkwind. This is a very important and legendary group from England, yeah.
Yeah, Hawkwind, big 1970s space rock band. And the Silver Machine was actually a radio hit in England. It wasn't a hit here, but so I was kind of joking. But it was a single. And they really kind of got the whole space rock aesthetic going. And also spawned Lemmy, who started Motorhead. So they're known for a lot of different things.
We've been joined by Rick Wilkerson, owner of Irvington Vinyl. Rick, tell folks a little bit about your shop and where they can find more information about your hours and address and all that stuff.
Irvington Vinyl is open 7 days a week. You can find everything you need to know pretty much either on our Facebook page or at irvingtonvinyl.com.
Thank you for being here, Rick. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Hear Kyle's A Cultural Manifesto on 90.1 WFYI Public Radio Wednesday nights at 9 or Saturday nights at 10. Thanks for listening to The Art of the Matter on 90.1 WFYI Public Radio. I'm Sharon Gamble, and today's contributors included Jill Dittmeyer, Shannon Forsell, and Alicia Hall. Hear The Art of the Matter Saturday mornings at 7 or join us Thursday nights at 9 after Indivisible. And remember, you can always listen to and share our podcast at WFYI.org. Next week, Ball State students lend their skills to remixing the symphony, and Dance Kaleidoscope alum Ricardo Melendez brings his current company to Indianapolis. And of course, we'll have that arts calendar we call What'll We Do? All of that and so much more on The Art of the Matter here on 90.1 WFYI Public Radio.
You've been listening to The Art of the Matter, a weekly show about the arts in Central Indiana and Indianapolis. The Art of the Matter is executive producer Roxana Caldwell, producer Melissa Davis, contributor Jill Dittmeyer, and host Sharon Gamble. The Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you.